Even people who are not at all religious end up making pilgrimages in middle age. These are the journeys to take care of ailing parents slowed by the grinding out of time. Many of us can relate. Today's guest wrote a book about his experience. George Hodgman is the author of the memoir Bettyville, about traveling back to his old hometown in rural Missouri to look after the Betty of the title and assess his and their earlier adventures in that town. George Hodgman is not only a writer, but an editor with years of experience editing books and magazines for major publishers. His writing has appeared in Harper's Bazaar and Entertainment Weekly, among other magazines. George Hodgman, thanks for joining us on the Jefferson Exchange.
Well, thank you for having me on the Jefferson Exchange.
Very good to have you. Paris, Missouri is not a place that generally stands next to modifiers like Cosmopolitan, does it?
Well, but it does stand next to some pretty positive ones, too.
Tell us a bit about the place. I mean, I'm mildly familiar with it myself. I've been there because I used to go to college in Columbia, right nearby, which is like the major town of central Missouri. But Paris itself is a bit removed, both, it seems like, in physical space and in time somewhat.
Well, it's Missouri has a lot of little towns. And Paris is 1,200 people, and it's lost population in the last 20 years. And, like, you know, it's very representative of a lot of little towns in America because the generation that my mother represents and the merchants and the people who, you know, sort of came after World War II and built the little houses and went to Rotary, and that class has been wiped out by Walmart, and the family farm is gone. There are only big farmers there now, and there are social problems, sort of big city social problems that have moved in. There's a bit of a drug issue, and it's a town that is kind of struggling to survive, but that has always maintained a lot of the really good small town virtues. There's, it's a place where people help each other, support each other. And being there, you know, I've come back from New York City to take care of my mom who has dementia and cancer. And being there, I've definitely benefited and been, you know, cheered up by the amount of support from people.
So it sounds like, I mean, even though, you know, growing up is never easy, I guess, and you were ended up in other places, New York City, Brooklyn, etc. It sounds like your feelings about the town are not particularly hard or I don't know, like not the kind of place you really wanted to just shake off and leave far behind you.
I have an awful lot of nostalgia about the town. I think it was one of the things that made coming back simpler. I never disliked the people. I was different from the people. I still have a lot of opinions, political opinions, that are quite different than most people there. But I also love them because, I mean, I grew up with small town characters. And one thing that I have always shared with a lot of Missourians is humor. Missourians are kind of sly. Mark Twain, you know, and the state has kind of a tradition of humor. And so it's home. You know, I think that you never, ever lose, or at least I've never lost my sense of connection to home.
You mentioned the circumstances of your mother with dementia and cancer. How's she doing these days?
She's had kind of a rough winter. We've sort of been through a recent battle with the lymphoma, and she's had a recent difficult round of radiation. We're just doing sort of light treatment, and the physical illness makes everything a bit worse, and also everything is worse in the winter when things are depressing.
How hard a winter has it been in Missouri? I know that they can be miserable. I remember some days in Columbia when I was like 10 below zero and a foot of snow on the ground.
Yeah, it hasn't been that bad. it hasn't been too bad, but it's still, you know, it's too cold for an older woman to be out and around. And my mother kind of needs that. My mother's a very don't fence me in kind of person.
Even to this day.
Well, she needs to get out. There's something about the wheels turning under my mother that makes her happy.
There's some great turns of phrase in the book. I mean, you bring up, there's this one, there's, for a second, there is the old Betty who does not appear often now, my old friend. Parents especially get locked in memory. I remember talking to friends years ago. It's like, what do you mean my dad's hair is gray? His hair is jet black. You know, he just hadn't really seen his parent in that context. But how had Betty gotten locked in your mind over the years?
Well, nobody knows what color Betty's hair really is. That would take a Senate investigation. But, you know, what I say, you know, as you said in that quote, I mean, there are all the Bettys. There are all the Bettys that I've known, who I've known through all the years. And in this period of our life, I feel like, you know, during the day, there are all the women who she's been, who sort of float past at different times. And I didn't know her as a child. But even now, I mean, it's not like she's regressing in some way, but she does have some sort of sweet, girlish qualities. At night, I tuck her into bed, and I always take a towel and put it in the dryer and warm it up and wrap it around her feet, and it's like, you know, it's like being with a little kid. She's very sweet, but she's also, you know, she's also spoiled and rebellious like a little kid sometimes.
All right, we'll learn a lot more about Betty and about George's dealings with her. The book is Bettyville, George Hodgman, the author. He's our guest on The Exchange. We'll come back and talk more with George and take phone calls and emails if you'd like to join us and swap stories. Back on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 10. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening and happy St. Patrick's Day. Our guest today is George Hodgman with his memoir Bettyville, about traveling back to his hometown in Missouri, Paris, Missouri, in fact, to take care of his mom, Betty, as cancer and dementia set in. Betty's still with us. George is with us today to talk about the whole situation. And you can join us on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760, anywhere in our listening area. 800-838-3760. And jx@jeffnet.org is our email address. George, you mentioned growing up mostly among adults in Paris. Who were your friends and companions as kids?
Well, My mother loved to play bridge, and she was in a lot of clubs. And so I had a lot of babysitters. It's one way I got to know the town. And I had a kind of quirky, crazy great aunt named Beth, who I stayed with a lot. And my mother's grandmother, who we call Mammy. And she was like, to me, she was this sort of heroic, strong American presence. And I talk in the book about there was a night when I was a little kid, and I was staying at her house, and I couldn't breathe because I didn't have my nose drops, and I woke her in the middle of the night, and the snow was coming down and down and swirling, and she was almost blind, but she got out to the car and drove us in the falling snow to my house so I could get my nose drops and breathe, and there's a woman I also talk about who ran the Rexall drugstore, and her name was Nadine, and her husband was the mayor, and he would ascend a ladder up the water tower just really high to put Christmas lights around the water tower, and those I remember them so well. But Nadine was kind of an eccentric character. She would let her 4-year-old son drive the car, and she was just incredibly memorable. She was sort of a free thinker in a town of people who were more conventional, and she wore, you know, amazing clothes. And I remember she would wear those, you know, the fur pieces with the animal faces on them.
Uh-huh.
And she wore turbans. And I don't know, she was a registered nurse, and we didn't have a doctor in the town. So she, if you got sick, Nadine would come to your house. And, you know, I remember her coming to my house in a turban, and like in a turban and tennis shoes. And she and her husband ran the Rexall, and they have this big soda fountain. And Nadine would wash her hair in the soda fountain and kind of stalk around the Rexall with her hair in a towel. And I would go in there and to read magazines. And I would read, like, Modern Screen and movie magazines and True Detective. And it was the only place in town where you could buy. They had this huge selection of magazines. So, you know, as a little kid, I was kind of a spy. Uh-huh. Because I was different. I knew that something was going on with me, and I didn't really like sports, and I wasn't, it wasn't like I really wanted to play the girls' things either, but I was interested, and I was interested in listening and seeing and hearing what people were doing.
When you compare notes with people in the big city, you know, people who grew up in, you know, suburbs or something like that, I mean, are you surprised at the lack of rich characters and experiences some of them have recall from their hometowns?
Well, I guess I would say that what I am is really grateful, because when I was growing up, you know, when I was in high school, the thing that I wanted to do most of all was get out of that town. You know, I wanted to go to New York, and I wanted to go to, you know, we went to the same school, University of Missouri, Columbia, and I was anxious to get away. But what, you know, listening to people who grew up in the suburbs, who I were my friends from, you know, Scarsdale to St. Louis, to, you know, it gradually dawned on me that I had an incredibly unique experience. And the older I get, the more magical it seems. And the more beautiful. I just remember walking on summer mornings when before it got really hot, and it was kind of cool, and the moisture would still be on the flowers, on the roses, and there were flowers blooming all over town, and people working in these big gardens, and just, you know, if you grow up in a town like that, the cliche is that everybody knows what you're doing. But if you're a little kid, you also feel like everybody, it's almost like they're holding you. You feel secure in this place. And I did. I had suspicions that I was different because I was gay, but I felt like I loved my home.
George Hodgman's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is Bettyville, a memoir about going back to Paris, Missouri to care for his mother. So what were the specific circumstances? There was a bit of an implosion on both ends of the journey, weren't there?
With me and my mom?
Right.
Well, I had, you know, I'd been working as an editor, and I worked at Vanity Fair. I worked at lots of publishing houses, Simon Schuster, and I lost my job, like a lot of editors now, and I was doing freelance work and working in my apartment at home. And, you know, since my father died in 1997, I've been spending more and more time with my mom, but I went home for her birthday, and she was trying to hide something from me. My mother's very... My mother has a lot of little tricks that old people know, and she had lost her driver's license, and she had violated the sort of agreement that we had come to, which was that she could only drive to Bridge Club and church and the grocery store very close. She had gone, she had driven out of town to a Bridge Club and had stayed out after dark, which was, you know, a no-no because she doesn't see well. And she had a little fender bender. And they turned her in. And I, and what she had done was go and get the handbook, the driving instruction handbook that the state of Missouri puts out to give to people who are going to take their test. Mm-hmm. And she and the lady who was our housekeeper, who's in her 70s, had been out, like, you know, practicing parallel parking and doing, you know, I wish I'd had a videotape of that. And so she'd lost her license, and she was marooned. And there I was, and I found this out. And you know, I guess we could have done something and gone to assisted living immediately, but I didn't. I knew that if my mother gave up home, if she gave up, she moved to a different town and lost her church, lost her Bridge Club, that she would lose her, and I wasn't ready to lose her.
She's so connected to that town. I mean, and again, it's like a strata that you see in the rock, you know, where the new layers of civilization kind of come on top of it. But this one is kind of still hanging on with the few members left, it sounds like. The pre-Wall Martians, I guess.
Well, I call my mother's Paris Bettyville, because Bettyville is sort of the place I grew up in, and it, you know, its identity was defined by my mother, who was defined by her mother, and you know, kind of the old-fashioned place, and that is what I'm nostalgic for. But I like, you know, I don't want to give the idea that I'm putting down the town as it is now, because a town is finally only its people. You know, the stores may be gone, and, you know, they may have to go to Walmart. You know, there are changes that I think threaten the community, but the people are great. And I think that sometimes we... You know, I'm a liberal, I'm a strong Democrat, but I feel that too many times that people like me stereotype others who, you know, live in rural places and who we perceive as unsophisticated or what, you know, these people are shrewd, they are hardworking, they're smart, they don't agree with me on many things, but... When it comes down to it, you know, they'd be there for me, at it, you know, through anything.
Bettyville is the name of George Hodgman's memoir about going back to visit his mom in Paris, Missouri, where he splits his time now. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760 around the region by email jx@jeffnet.org. I asked if you could pick out a passage in the book to read from, and you offered something up on page 39, a bit of a description of Paris, it sounds like.
Yes, hold on. I'll read that now on the radio.
Thank you.
The morning began with a long stretch of pink sky. In the backyard, I spotted a young deer straining its neck to feed from the low-hanging branch of one of the trees my father planted years ago. Staring, the deer tilted his head to the side and assessed me quizzically. At Abel's Quick Store, the girl behind the counter, wearing a badge saying trainee, stared at me in much the same way. I have become an object of puzzlement to all species. At home, Betty ignored me, something brewing. Soon the phone began to ring, a rarity, one call after the other. First came the tidings of one of my mother's friends. Her daughter has had a baby. She feared it has an oddly shaped head. Next, someone from the Bridge Club. She has a bladder infection. So prevalent are references to bladders in my mother's circle that I have come to think of them fondly, like a quirky, hard-to-control family who might soon be arriving for dinner. Next, it was the church about the meeting later, then a recorded message announcing Betty's upcoming appointment with her general practitioner. Refusing the telephone herself, my mother balked at even being called to the receiver. On the line, she oozed the frustration of a mob boss dissatisfied with the morning tallies from Vegas. By the third or fourth summons, she was greeting her callers with, "Speak!" Then came Waikiki coiffures. When I started to put Betty on, the shop's owner stopped me, asked, "Are you her son?" "Maybe," I said. "Is there a problem?" Apparently, Betty almost fell on her last visit. The owner cannot risk a lawsuit if Betty tumbles down next week. I say we are not litigious types. We are peaceful folk, despite occasional fits of rage after a comb out. I beg her understanding, but no. From here on, my mother will have to be accompanied by someone who will wait while she gets her hair done. I watch Betty, who eyed me gravely, her sixth sense for trouble in high gear. "Yes, she is sometimes shaky on her feet," I told the caller. "But the biggest problem," I argued, "is her shoes." The woman agreed. She said the soles on Betty's sandals are worn down enough to make her trip. After hanging up, I explained the situation to Betty, who slammed her book down on the couch. "I'm 90 years old, and everybody in town is telling me what to do." When she clicked the remote control device, I swore she was pointing it at me.
Which is followed by, "Be still, just be still."
"Be still," she yelled, "just be still."
George Hodgman reading from his memoir, Bettyville. The descriptions in here are rich and gorgeous, and you love Betty almost instantly, and thank you for delivering her to us. How openly can you and she talk about her health, about living options, and so forth?
Well, we sort of, we do it one day at a time. We sort of, you know, we do things as they come. We deal with problems as they come because you never know. You know, you can make plans. I know my mother's preferences in terms of end of life, and I know she doesn't want to suffer or, you know, live, unnecessarily. And but we, you know, we talk as things happen. She had cancer, and she made the choice. She made the choice of the treatment, and she listened to the doctor, and she spoke right up. And she said, "This is what I want."
You write about her crankiness. There's a vignette early in the book. You write of it being a kind of a cover. But your mom sounds like she could be quite a character, and certainly has been over the years. In fact, there's this line where you say she could turn a game of golf into a disaster movie. What do you mean by that?
She turned a game of golf into a what? I can't remember.
A disaster movie.
Well, she was. My mother always had a kind of screwball side. She was funny in the kitchen. She, kind of burned things, and she, there was a kind of a Lucy Ricardo feeling about my mother at times. And, as she has gotten older, yeah, she's gotten a little bit more stern. She's gotten a little bit more cranky, but I kind of like it because it does make her a character. And she's funny. She's more, you know, she's much more frank. She's much more direct. She says it. She says it straight out. And I always say, you know, I would never want just another damn sweet old lady. My mother is herself, and that's what I love about her. And that has not gone away. It's become more intensified. And the reason I wrote this book is because, you know, I could never have written a Hallmark card of a, you know, Caring for Mama book or a, you know, a point-by-point guide for elder care. This, you know, people who see my mother and I together say, "You two are funny." You know, "You two are funny." And we may not say "I love you" out loud, but we joke with each other. And we're two characters coming together. And this is a book about how it's not just caring for someone with dementia. It's about if you go back, you know, you can have this time that is really special. And I've talked to so many people who have, you know, spent time with their older parents in one way or another. And every single person has said, you will not regret this. You will not regret it. And I know I won't, because I like her. I just like her.
It's a great relationship, and the back and forth is a lot of fun. There's quite a banter between you. I want to get into a bit about the character that your father was as well before he died in 1997. We'll come back and talk more with George Hodgman about Bettyville. We'll take your phone calls and emails as well if you'd like to join us and visit with George. Back on the Jefferson Exchange with George Hodgman and you in a minute 30. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is George Hodgman, who has been the editor of books and magazines for many a year, has written his own book In Bettyville, a memoir of returning to his hometown in central Missouri to look after his ailing mother, but also to get to know her again after all these years. It's frequently moving and frequently funny, and it's just about life in Bettyville. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760 or by email
jfx@jeffnet.org.
Yes, you are. And we have a call for you, George. Here's Julie in Ashland. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Hello there. I wanted to thank you for writing a book with so much compassion for another human being. And I particularly feel this is so important, and I know you're an editor, so I hope you keep getting books like this published in the world. Because, and this is just a political kind of a fear that I have. I've heard a lot about artificial intelligence. And it's important to document the human species, I think, with the love and compassion and dimension that we actually do have and do live. We may not be as fast as a computer all the time, but, you know, there's value. We need to treasure that and uphold it and stand for it. So thank you.
All right. Thanks for the call, Julie. Appreciate that. George, you've gotten some praise like that along the way for Bettyville, I understand.
Well, I have, and I'm grateful for it, and I'm grateful for your comment, of course. I think one of the points of the book is that I was a very ambitious, career-driven New Yorker, and I never had a kid. I barely could care for a plant. I was, you know, scared to get a dog for fear it would die, and I didn't think I could. You know, I dreaded my parents' old age, and you know, I just didn't think I was up to the task of doing this, of dealing with my mother's departure. Extended departure, and I think that this is a book for anybody who is scared, anybody who thinks they can't do it, because there's nobody who is less equipped to do this. And I can't cook, I can't figure out insurance forms, but I think that what I would say, and what your caller and I would probably agree with, is that these are the things that make us human. And these are the things that at the end of the day, we are responsible, I believe, for helping each other when we're in trouble.
Betty was, with the loss of driver's license and advancing dementia and cancer. The book is obviously not named after your father. We haven't talked about him very much at all. It sounds like together in their heyday, they were quite the couple and performers, it sounds like, too.
Oh, they were fun. My father is from St. Louis, and he grew up singing. He was in the chorus in the municipal opera in St. Louis when he was a young guy, and he always sang at church, and he sang for funerals, and he was kind of the go-to guy when you needed a number in Madison and in Paris, Missouri, and you know, so many people remember him for his singing. And he was also just a whole lot of fun. Mm-hmm. And he was mischievous. And he, you know, he loved to party. And I, but he was always singing. And I, you know, one of my memories of him is I would be in my bed and he would be in the bathroom shaving, and he would sing that Nat King Cole song, Mona Lisa.
Oh, yeah. Men have named you. Yeah. It's it sounds like the real alliance was between you and your mom, though, always.
Well, I think that it's just, I think that we were temperamentally more similar. I mean, I think that I'm very allied with my father, too. I think that the alliance between me and my mother comes more through in Beattyville, because, you know, it's focused more on the two of us because he's not there anymore. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it was very shifting. Sometimes I would feel like it was me and my father, and we would sort of like shake our heads at Betty. And other times I would, you know, it would be me and my mother, and we would be like, you know, rolling our eyes at my dad.
So the alliance has shifted a lot. You point out in the book, your dad once said, "You can always tell me anything." But how honest were you with your parents about your sexuality?
We didn't talk about it. You know, we didn't talk about it. We didn't talk about, you know, my being gay. We, you know, it was just not something that was on their screen in terms of being able to understand. They were of another era, and they lived in this small town, and nobody was gay, nobody was open, and they were also of a generation that really weren't grown up to be touchy-feely and discuss a lot of their feelings. And you know, I didn't know how. And they didn't know how. And so we didn't do very well on that score. We did really well on all the scores. But
mm-hmm. Tell us about the day you found the book, The Gay Mystique, in the library in a nearby town. The ways you went to conceal it are very funny.
Well, I didn't know how to be gay. I didn't know if I was. I didn't know exactly what it was or what you were supposed to do. I'd heard that word, and I instinctively responded to it, but I was worried because I almost always heard, you know, sin against God. But I went to the library, and I started looking around, rummaging around, and if the librarian would come in, I would slam the book shut, and I found this book called The Gay Mystique, and it had a resource guide in the back, and I figured that I was the only gay person within, you know, thousands of miles, so it wouldn't hurt if I just tore that page out. And so I tore that page out, and I wrote some letters to the people in the resource guide, and there was a newspaper, there still is a gay newspaper in San Francisco called The Advocate, and I sent them $5, and I said, please send however many issues this will buy. And I waited. It was the summer, and I would always check the mail and make sure that, you know, that my mother didn't find it.
You got there first, yeah.
Yeah, it was pretty. But it was an urgency that I felt. You know, I was, one of the reasons that I wrote the book is that I, you know, I felt very much alone with this when I was a kid. And I think that there are probably kids in small towns across America who still feel very alone with it. And I'm hoping that parents and children will read this book and think, gee, let's let's deal here. You know, let's help each other through this. And as so many have learned to do. But I worry about those kids. I mean, in Oklahoma right now, there's a representative named Sally Kern who is trying to revive the idea of conversion therapy, which doesn't work, the notion that, you know, you can change a gay kid to heterosexual. And it's psychologically damaging. It guarantees that these kids will grow up with a life of shame and feeling terrible about themselves. And, you know, I hope that people will read my book and see this little boy and say, you know, he's okay. You know, we don't, these people are hurting children.
It's kind of surprising to hear about gay conversion therapy still gaining traction anywhere because it has been widely, widely discredited.
Yeah. And that's, I mean, I am feeling in the last few years, and that's part of some material in the book came out of, is that we really have to be on our toes, because there will always be people who are going to try and force us back into punishing existences. And little kids don't have any way to fight that. And there's, you know, to make a kid feel shame about who he or she is almost murder.
You detail some stuff in the book about trying out for the football team, the high school football team, where there was one person who called you all the names you can imagine, and some of which we can't say on the radio. But it sounds like, despite that, you had a pretty decent time in high school.
I had this one bad period. You know, I was the new kid. And I had no business playing football. I mean, I knew I could have done nuclear physics easier. I was the worst athlete that there ever was. There's this sort of complicated system of pads that they give you when you play football. I didn't even know where to put the pads. I didn't have the body parts. You know, and And I was bullied. I was bullied by this guy who made 1 year of my life a living hell. But then I learned to use humor. And I think a lot of gay kids learn to use humor. They may not be able to, you know, excel at some of the, you know, the gender specific things that straight kids can do. But, you know, I found what worked for me, and I also found people, you know, I had great friends, and I loved, you know, I would race to school. I was at school at 7 o'clock in the morning.
Wow.
Because I had three incredibly happy years.
That sounds great. You said, though, that there was a condition of watching yourself that started at that time in your life. And has that led up at all over the years?
Oh, I'm hoping it'll let up during this phone call. It's one thing that you have to... It's a tendency. It's bred in the bone.
Mm-hmm.
I really think the gay kids... They grow up with, you know, honing the instinct, learning where it's safe, who it's safe to be yourself with, and who you have to really watch out for. And part of that watching out is that you don't let your real self out. And you know, there's still times, and unfortunately, those times are often when I'm away from New York, when I'm back home, there are still times when I fall into that kind of monitoring. I don't think I'm quite as at ease in territory that is conservative than I am in New York.
Mm-hmm. How about around Betty? I mean, do you find you can truly be who you are in, I mean, today's context with Betty there? I mean, given that, you know, there's so much history between you and the circumstances have changed as well with her infirmity.
You know what? Betty and I have reached the point, and I think you'll see it in this book, where we have been through so much, and we are, you know, we're tired. We've been through, you know, we're fighting dementia. We're fighting cancer. We're, you know, it's like we have reached the point where we cannot be anything but each other, ourselves with each other. That's one of the things that's really nice about this period is that, you know, she's not worried anymore about being capital M mother. She's Betty. And I am, you know, I'm not able anymore. I'm too old to be anybody but myself. And I think that's what you see in Bettyville's this memoir is that these people who are coming together and it's a new chapter. It's a new chapter where they really can be out and out with each other. They may drive each other crazy sometimes, but they're real. This is real.
It truly is a heartwarming book, and I want to let our listeners in the Mendocino area know, because they're the closest to you, that if they feel like a drive into the city today, that you can actually see George Hodgman in an appearance at Books, Inc. in the Castro at 7:30 tonight. Is that still scheduled, George?
Yes.
All right. Well, it's been a pleasure to talk to you today. It was a pleasure to read the book, Bettyville, and I hope we get a chance to talk again down the road.
I really thank you for having me, have a good day.
All right, take care. Bye-bye. And that'll do it for today's exchange. You can find out more about the program and subjects and suggest a guest at jeffexchange.org. You'll find show topics and recordings on our Facebook page as well, the same links available on Twitter. If you're listening in the morning, The Takeaway is coming up next. Our evening rebroadcast is followed by news from the BBC. Guests are scheduled by Charlotte Duran. Our associate producer at the controls today, Colleen Pike. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thanks for listening. Please join us next time on the Jefferson Exchange, and have a great day. Wednesday on the Jefferson Exchange at 8, our Events Day segment lets you get your feelings off your chest about the senator's letter to Iran or about the annual ritual of adjusting to daylight saving time. At 9, we'll talk about Sunshine Week. It's not related to saving time, but about the government practices and documents that see the light of day. Join us for Wednesday's exchange, and you can listen to today's program rebroadcast tonight, 8 to 10 on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio.